and flattered, so that they might go happily to the stone and not outrage the gods with unhappiness. Cyrus explained softly to Adam the nature of a soldier, and though his knowledge came from research rather than experience, he knew, and he was accurate. He told his son of the sad dignity that can belong to a soldier, how he is necessary in the light of all the failures of man, the penalty of our frailties. Perhaps Cyrus discovered these things in himself as he told them. It was very different from the flag-waving, shouting bellicosity of his younger days. The humilities are piled on a soldier, so Cyrus said, in order that he may, when the time comes, be not too resentful of the final humility, a meaningless and dirty death. And Cyrus talked to Adam alone, and didn't permit Charles to listen. Cyrus took Adam to walk with him one late afternoon, and the black conclusions of all his study and his thinking came out and flowed with a kind of thick terror over his son. He said, "I'll have you know that a soldier is the most holy of all humans, because he is the most tested of all. I'll try to tell you. Look now. In all of history, men have been taught that killing of men is an evil thing, not to be countenanced. Any man who kills must be destroyed, because this is a great sin, maybe the worst sin we know. And then we take a soldier and put murder in his hands, and we say to him, 'Use it well, use it wisely.' We put no checks on him. Go out and kill as many of a certain kind or classification of your brothers as you can, and we will reward you for it, because it is a violation of your early training." Adam wet his dry lips and tried to ask, and failed, and tried again. "Why do they have to do it?" he said. "Why is it?" Cyrus was deeply moved, and he spoke as he had never spoken before. "I don't know," he said. "I've studied and maybe learned how things are, but I'm not even close to why they are. And you must not expect to find that people understand what they do. So many things are done instinctively, the way a bee makes honey or a fox dips his paws in a stream to fool dogs. A fox can't say why he does it, and what bee remembers winter or expects it to come again? When I knew you had to go, I thought to leave the future open so you could dig out your own findings. And then it seemed better if I could protect you with the little I know. You'll go in soon now. You've come to the age."
"I don't want to," said Adam quickly.
"You'll go in soon," his father went on, not hearing. "And I want to tell you so you won't be surprised. They'll first strip off your clothes, but they'll go deeper than that. They'll shuck off any little dignity you have. You'll lose what you think of as your decent right to live, and to be let alone to live. They'll make you live and eat and sleep and shit close to other men. And when they dress you up again, you'll not be able to tell yourself from the others. You can't even wear a scrap or pin a note on your breast to say, 'This is me, separate from the rest.'"
"I don't want to do it," said Adam.
"After a while," said Cyrus, "you'll think no thought the others do not think. You'll know no word the others can't say. And you'll do things because the others do them. You'll feel the danger in any difference whatever, a danger to the whole crowd of like-thinking, like-acting men."
"What if I don't?" Adam demanded.
"Yes," said Cyrus, "sometimes that happens. Once in a while there is a man who won't do what is demanded of him. And you know what happens? The whole machine devotes itself coldly to the destruction of his difference. They'll beat your spirit and your nerves, your body and your mind, with iron rods until the dangerous difference goes out of you. And if you can't finally give in, they'll vomit you up and leave you stinking outside, neither part of themselves nor yet free. It's better to fall in with them. They only do it to protect themselves. A thing so triumphantly illogical, so beautifully senseless as an army, can't allow a question to weaken it. Within itself, if you don't hold it up to other things for comparison and derision, you'll find slowly, surely, a reason and a logic, and a kind of dreadful beauty. A man who can accept it is not a worse man always, and sometimes is a much better man. Pay good heed to me, for I've thought long about it. Some men there are who go down the dismal rack of soldiering, surrender themselves, and become faceless. But these had not much face to start with, and maybe you're like that. But there are others who go down, submerge in the common slough, and then rise more themselves than they were, because they have lost a littleness of vanity, and have gained all the gold of the company and the regiment. If you can go down so low, you will be able to rise higher than you can conceive, and you will know a holy joy, a companionship, almost like that of a heavenly company of angels. Then you will know the quality of men, even if they are inarticulate. But until you have gone way down, you can never know this. As they walked back toward the house, Cyrus turned left and entered the woodlot among the trees, and it was dusk. Suddenly, Adam said, "You see that stump there, sir? I used to hide between the roots on the far side. After you punished me, I used to hide there, and sometimes I went there just because I felt bad." "Let's go and see the place," his father said. Adam led him to it, and Cyrus looked down at the nest-like hole between the roots. "I knew about it long ago," he said. "Once when you were gone a long time, I thought you must have such a place. And I found it because I felt the kind of a place you would need. See how the earth is tamped and the little grass is torn? And while you sat in there, you stripped little pieces of bark to shreds. I knew it was the place when I came upon it." Adam was staring at his father in wonder.
"You never came here looking for me," he said.
"No," Cyrus replied. "I wouldn't do that. You can drive a human too far. I wouldn't do that. Always you must leave a man one escape before death. Remember that. I knew, I guess, how hard I was pressing you. I didn't want to push you over the edge." They moved restlessly off through the trees. Cyrus said, "So many things I want to tell you. I'll forget most of them. I want to tell you that a soldier gives up so much to get something back. From the day of a child's birth, he is taught by every circumstance, by every law and rule and right, to protect his own life. He starts with that great instinct, and everything confirms it. And then he is a soldier, and he must learn to violate all of this. He must learn coldly to put himself in the way of losing his own life without going mad. And if you can do that, and mind you, some can't, then you will have the greatest gift of all." "Look, son," Cyrus said earnestly, "nearly all men are afraid. And they don't even know what causes their fear. Shadows, perplexities, dangers without names or numbers, fear of a faceless death. But if you can bring yourself to face not shadows, but real death, described and recognizable, by bullet or saber, arrow or lance, then you need never be afraid again, at least not in the same way you were before. Then you will be a man set apart from other men, safe where other men may cry in terror. This is the great reward. Maybe this is the only reward. Maybe this is the final purity, all ringed with filth. It's nearly dark. I want to talk to you again tomorrow night, when both of us have thought about what I've told you." But Adam said,
"Why don't you talk to my brother? Charles will be going. He'll be good at it, much better than I am."
"Charles won't be going," Cyrus said. "There'd be no point in it."
"But he would be a better soldier."
"Only outside on his skin," said Cyrus. "Not inside. Charles isn't afraid, so he could never learn anything about courage. He doesn't know anything outside himself, so he could never gain the things I've tried to explain to you. To put him in an army would be to let loose things which in Charles must be chained down, not let loose. I wouldn't dare to let him go. Adam complained. You never punished him. You let him live his life. You praised him. You didn't haze him. And now you let him stay out of the army. He stopped, frightened of what he had said, afraid of the rage or the contempt or the violence his words might let loose. His father didn't reply. He walked on out of the woodlot, and his head hung down so that his chin rested on his chest, and the rise and fall of his hip when his wooden leg struck the ground was monotonous. The wooden leg made a side semicircle to get ahead when its turn came. It was completely dark by now, and the golden light of the lamps shone out from the open kitchen door. Alice came to the doorway and peered out, looking for them. And then she heard the uneven footsteps approaching and went back to the kitchen. Cyrus walked to the kitchen stoop before he stopped and raised his head. "Where are you?" he asked.
"Here, right behind you, right here."
"You asked a question. I guess I'll have to answer. Maybe it's good and maybe it's bad to answer it. You're not clever. You don't know what you want. You have no proper fierceness. You let other people walk over you. Sometimes I think you're a weakling who will never amount to a dog turd. Does that answer your question? I love you better. I always have. This may be a bad thing to tell you, but it's true. I love you better. Else why would I have given myself the trouble of hurting you? Now shut your mouth and go to your supper. I'll talk to you tomorrow night. My leg aches."
This ends Disc 1. East of Eden, Disc 2.
There was no talk at supper. The quiet was disturbed only by the slup of soup and gnash of chewing, and his father waved his hand to try to drive the moths away from the chimney of the kerosene lamp. Adam thought his brother watched him secretly, and he caught an eye flash from Alice when he looked up suddenly. After he had finished eating, Adam pushed back his chair.
"I think I'll go for a walk," he said.
Charles stood up.
"I'll go with you."
Alice and Cyrus watched them go out the door, and then she asked one of her rare questions. She asked nervously,
"What did you do?"
"Nothing," he said.
"Will you make him go?"
"Yes."
"Does he know?"
Cyrus stared bleakly out the open door into the darkness. "Yes, he knows."
"He won't like it. It's not right for him."
"It doesn't matter," Cyrus said, and he repeated loudly, "It doesn't matter." And his tone said, "Shut your mouth, this is not your affair." They were silent a moment, and then he said, almost in a tone of apology, "It isn't as though he were your child." Alice did not reply. The boys walked down the dark, rutty road. Ahead, they could see a few pinched lights where the village was.
"Want to go in and see if anything's stirring at the inn?" Charles asked.
"I hadn't thought of it," said Adam.
"Then what the hell are you walking out at night for?"
"You didn't have to come," said Adam.
Charles moved close to him.
"What did he say to you this afternoon? I saw you walking together. What did he say?"
"He just talked about the army, like always."
"Didn't look like that to me," Charles said suspiciously. "I saw him leaning close, talking the way he talks to men. Not telling, talking."
"He was telling," Adam said patiently, and he had to control his breath, for a little fear had begun to press up against his stomach. He took as deep a gulp of air as he could and held it to push back at the fear.
"What did he tell you?"
Charles demanded again. About the army and how it is to be a soldier.
I don't believe you, said Charles. I think you're a goddamn mealy-mouthed liar. What are you trying to get away with?
Nothing, said Adam.
Charles said harshly, Your crazy mother drowned herself. Maybe she took a look at you. That'd do it.
Adam let out his breath gently, pressing down the dismal fear. He was silent.
Charles cried, You're trying to take him away. I don't know how you're going about it. What do you think you're doing?
Nothing, said Adam.
Charles jumped in front of him so that Adam had to stop, his chest almost against his brother's chest. Adam backed away, but carefully, as one backs away from a snake. Look at his birthday, Charles shouted. I took 6 bits, and I bought him a knife made in Germany. 3 blades and a corkscrew, pearl-handled. Where's that knife? Do you ever see him use it? Did he give it to you? I never even saw him hone it. Have you got that knife in your pocket? What did he do with it? Thanks, he said, like that. And that's the last I heard of a pearl-handled German knife that cost 6 bits.
Rage was in his voice, and Adam felt the creeping fear. But he knew also that he had a moment left. Too many times he had seen the destructive machine that chopped down anything standing in its way. Rage came first, and then a coldness, a possession. Non-committal eyes and a pleased smile, and no voice at all, only a whisper. When that happened, murder was on the way, but cool, deft murder, and hands that worked precisely, delicately. Adam swallowed saliva to dampen his dry throat. He could think of nothing to say that would be heard, for once in rage, his brother wouldn't listen, wouldn't even hear. He bulked darkly in front of Adam, shorter, wider, thicker, but still not crouched. In the starlight, his lips shone with wetness, but there was no smile yet, and his voice still raged.
What did you do on his birthday? You think I didn't see? Did you spend 6 bits, or even 4 bits? You brought him a mongrel pup you picked up on the woodlot. You laughed like a fool and said it would make a good bird dog. That dog sleeps in his room. He plays with it while he's reading. He's got it all trained. And where's the knife? Thanks, he said. Just thanks.
Charles spoke in a whisper, and his shoulders dropped.
Adam made one desperate jump backward and raised his hands to guard his face. His brother moved precisely, each foot planted firmly. One fist lanced delicately to get the range, and then the bitter, frozen work. A hard blow in the stomach, and Adam's hands dropped. Then 4 punches to the head. Adam felt the bone and gristle of his nose crunch. He raised his hands again, and Charles drove at his heart. And all this time Adam looked at his brother as the condemned look hopelessly and puzzled at the executioner. Suddenly, to his own surprise, Adam launched a wild, overhand, harmless swing which had neither force nor direction. Charles ducked in and under it, and the helpless arm went around his neck. Adam wrapped his arms around his brother and hung close to him, sobbing. He felt the square fists whipping nausea into his stomach, and still he held on. Time was slowed to him. With his body, he felt his brother move sideways to force his legs apart. And he felt the knee come up, past his knees, scraping his thighs, until it crashed against his testicles, and flashing white pain ripped and echoed through his body. His arms let go. He bent over and vomited, while the cold killing went on. Adam felt the punches on temples, cheeks, eyes. He felt his lips split and tatter over his teeth. But his skin seemed thickened and dull, as though he were encased in heavy rubber. Dully, he wondered why his legs didn't buckle, why he didn't fall, why unconsciousness didn't come to him. The punching continued eternally. He could hear his brother panting with the quick, explosive breath of a sledgehammer man,
and in the sick, starlit dark, he could see his brother through the tear-watered blood that flowed from his eyes. He saw the innocent, non-committal eyes, the small smile on wet lips. And as he saw these things, a flash of light and darkness. Charles stood over him, gulping air like a run-out dog. And then he turned and walked quickly back toward the house, kneading his bruised knuckles as he went. Consciousness came back quick and frightening to Adam. His mind rolled in a painful mist. His body was heavy and thick with hurt. But almost instantly he forgot his hurts. He heard quick footsteps on the road. The instinctive fear and fierceness of a rat came over him. He pushed himself up on his knees and dragged himself off the road to the ditch that kept it drained. There was a foot of water in the ditch, and the tall grass grew up from its sides. Adam crawled quietly into the water, being very careful to make no splash. The footsteps came close, slowed, moved on a little, came back. And from his hiding place, Adam could see only a darkness in the dark. And then a sulfur match was struck and burned a tiny blue until the wood caught, lighting his brother's face grotesquely from below. Charles raised the match and peered around, and Adam could see the hatchet in his right hand. When the match went out, the night was blacker than before. Charles moved slowly on and struck another match, and on and struck another. He searched the road for signs. At last he gave it up. His right hand rose, and he threw the hatchet far off into the field. He walked rapidly away toward the pinched lights of the village. For a long time, Adam lay in the cool water. He wondered how his brother felt, wondered whether now that his passion was chilling, he would feel panic or sorrow or sick conscience or nothing. These things Adam felt for him. His conscience bridged him to his brother and did his pain for him the way at other times he had done his homework. Adam crept out of the water and stood up. His hurts were stiffening and the blood was dried and a crust on his face. He thought he would stay outside in the darkness until his father and Alice went to bed. He felt that he couldn't answer any questions because he didn't know any answers, and trying to find one was harsh to his battered mind. Dizziness, edged with blue lights, came fringing his forehead, and he knew that he would be fainting soon. He shuffled slowly up the road with widespread legs. At the stoop, he paused, looked in. The lamp hanging by its chain from the ceiling cast a yellow circle and lighted Alice and her mending basket on the table in front of her. On the other side, his father chewed a wooden pen and dipped it in an open ink bottle and made entries in his black record book. Alice, glancing up, saw Adam's bloody face. Her hand rose to her mouth and her fingers hooked over her lower teeth. Adam drag-footed up one step and then the other and supported himself in the doorway. Then Cyrus raised his head. He looked with a distant curiosity. The identity of the distortion came to him slowly. He stood up, puzzled and wondering. He stuck the wooden pen in the ink bottle and wiped his fingers on his pants.
"Why did he do it?"
Cyrus asked softly. Adam tried to answer, but his mouth was caked and dry. He licked his lips and started them bleeding again.
"I don't know,"
he said. Cyrus stumped over to him and grasped him by the arm so fiercely that he winced and tried to pull away.
"Don't lie to me. Why did he do it? Did you have an argument?"
"No."
Cyrus wrenched at him. "Tell me. I want to know. Tell me. You'll have to tell me. I'll make you tell me. God damn it, you're always protecting him. Don't you think I know that? Did you think you were fooling me? Now tell me, or by God, I'll keep you standing there all night."
Adam cast about for an answer.
He doesn't think you love him."
Cyrus released the arm and hobbled back to his chair and sat down. He rattled the pen in the ink bottle
and looked blindly at his record book. "Alice," he said, "help Adam to bed. You'll have to cut his shirt off, I guess. Give him a hand." He got up again, went to the corner of the room where the coats hung on nails, and, reaching behind the garments, brought out his shotgun, broke it to verify its load, and clumped out the door. Alice raised her hand as though she would hold him back with a rope of air, and her rope broke, and her face hid her thoughts.
"Go in your room," she said. "I'll bring some water in a basin."
Adam lay on the bed, a sheet pulled up to his waist, and Alice patted the cuts with a linen handkerchief dipped in warm water. She was silent for a long time, and then she continued Adam's sentence as though there had never been an interval.
"He doesn't think his father loves him.
But you love him. You always have." Adam didn't answer her. She went on quietly.
"He's a strange boy. You have to know him. All rough shell, all anger, until you know."
She paused to cough, leaned down and coughed. And when the spell was over, her cheeks were flushed and she was exhausted.
"You have to know him," she repeated. "For a long time, he has given me little presents. Pretty things. You wouldn't think he'd even notice. But he doesn't give them right out. He hides them where he knows I'll find them. And you can look at him for hours, and he won't ever give the slightest sign he did it. You have to know him."
She smiled at Adam, and he closed his eyes. Chapter 4. Charles stood at the bar in the village inn, and Charles was laughing delightedly at the funny stories the night-stranded drummers were telling. He got out his tobacco sack with its meager jingle of silver and bought the men a drink to keep them talking. He stood and grinned and rubbed his split knuckles. And when the drummers, accepting his drink, raised their glasses and said, "Here's to you," Charles was delighted. He ordered another drink for his new friends, and then he joined them for some kind of deviltry in another place. When Cyrus stumped out into the night, he was filled with a kind of despairing anger at Charles. He looked on the road for his son, and he went to the inn to look for him, but Charles was gone. It's probable that if he had found him that night, he would have killed him, or tried to. The direction of a big act will warp history, but probably all acts do the same in their degree, down to a stone stepped over in the path, or a breath caught at sight of a pretty girl, or a fingernail nicked in the garden soil. Naturally, it was not long before Charles was told that his father was looking for him with a shotgun. He hid out for 2 weeks, and when he finally did return, murder had sunk back to simple anger, and he paid his penalty in overwork and a false theatrical humility. Adam lay 4 days in bed, so stiff and aching that he couldn't move without a groan. On the third day, his father gave evidence of his power with the military. He did it as a poultice to his own pride, and also as a kind of prize for Adam. Into the house, into Adam's bedroom, came a captain of cavalry and two sergeants in dress uniform of blue. In the dooryard, their horses were held by two privates. Lying in his bed, Adam was enlisted in the army as a private in the cavalry. He signed the Articles of War and took the oath while his father and Alice looked on. His father's eyes glistened with tears. After the soldiers had gone, his father sat with him a long time.
"I've put you in the cavalry for a reason," he said. "Barrack life is not a good life for long, but the cavalry has work to do. I made sure of that. You'll like going for the Indian country. There's action coming. I can't tell you how I know. There's fighting on the way."
"Yes, sir," Adam said.
"It has always seemed strange to me,"
that it is usually men like Adam who have to do the soldiering. He didn't like fighting to start with, and far from learning to love it as some men do, he felt an increasing revulsion for violence. Several times his officers looked closely at him for malingering, but no charge was brought. During these 5 years of soldiering, Adam did more detail work than any man in the squadron. But if he killed any enemy, it was an accident of ricochet. Being a marksman and sharpshooter, he was peculiarly fitted to miss. By this time, the Indian fighting had become like dangerous cattle drives. The tribes were forced into revolt, driven and decimated, and the sad, sullen remnants settled on starvation lands. It wasn't nice work, but given the pattern of the country's development, it had to be done. To Adam, who was an instrument, who saw not the future farms, but only the torn bellies of fine humans, it was revolting and useless. When he fired his carbine to miss, he was committing treason against his unit, and he didn't care. The emotion of nonviolence was building in him, until it became a prejudice, like any other thought-stultifying prejudice. To inflict any hurt on anything for any purpose became inimical to him. He became obsessed with this emotion, for such it surely was, until it blotted out any possible thinking in its area. But never was there any hint of cowardice in Adam's army record. Indeed, he was commended 3 times, and then decorated for bravery. As he revolted more and more from violence, his impulse took the opposite direction. He ventured his life a number of times to bring in wounded men. He volunteered for work in field hospitals, even when he was exhausted from his regular duties. He was regarded by his comrades with contemptuous affection and the unspoken fear men have of impulses they don't understand. Charles wrote his brother regularly, of the farm and the village, of sick cows and a foaling mare, of the added pasture and the lightning-struck barn, of Alice's choking death from her consumption, and his father's move to a permanent paid position in the GAR in Washington. As with many people, Charles, who couldn't talk, wrote with fullness. He set down his loneliness and his perplexities, and he put on paper many things he did not know about himself. During the time Adam was away, he knew his brother better than ever before or afterward. In the exchange of letters, there grew a closeness neither of them could have imagined. Adam kept one letter from his brother, not because he understood it completely, but because it seemed to have a covered meaning he could not get at. "Dear Brother Adam," the letter said, "I take my pen in hand to hope you are in good health." He always started this way to ease himself gently into the task of writing. "I have not had your answer to my last letter, but I presume you have other things to do. Ha ha." The rain came wrong and damned the apple blossoms. There won't be many to eat next winter, but I will save what I can. Tonight I cleaned the house, and it is wet and soapy and maybe not any cleaner. How do you suppose Mother kept it the way she did? It does not look the same. Something settles down on it. I don't know what, but it will not scrub off. But I have spread the dirt around more evenly anyways. Ha ha. Did Father write you anything about his trip? He's gone clean out to San Francisco in California for an encampment of the Grand Army. The Secretary of War is going to be there, and Father is to introduce him. But this is not any great shucks to Father. He has met the President 3-4 times, and even been to supper to the White House. I'd like to see the White House. Maybe you and me can go together when you come home. Father could put us up for a few days, and he would be wanting to see you anyways. I think I better look around for a wife. This is a good farm, and even if I'm no bargain, there's girls could do worse than this farm. What do you think? You did not say if you're going to come live home when you get out of the army. I hope so. I miss you.
The writing stopped there. There was a scratch on the page and a splash of ink, and then it went on in pencil. But the writing was different. In pencil it said, "Later." Well, right there the pen give out. One of the points broke off. I'll have to buy another pen point in the village. Rusted right through. The words began to flow more smoothly. I guess I should wait for a new pen point and not write with a pencil. Only I was sitting here in the kitchen with the lamp on, and I guess I got to thinking, and it come on late. After 12, I guess, but I never looked. Old Black Joe started crowing out in the henhouse. Then Mother's rocking chair cricked for all the world like she was sitting in it. You know, I don't take truck with that, but it set me minding backwards. You know how you do sometimes. I guess I'll tear this letter up, maybe, because what's the good of writing stuff like this? The words began to race now, as though they couldn't get out fast enough. If I'm to throw it away, I just as well set it down, the letter said. It's like the whole house was alive and had eyes everywhere, and like there was people behind the door just ready to come in if you looked away. It kind of makes my skin crawl. I never understood, well, why our father did it. I mean, why he didn't like that knife I bought for him on his birthday. Why didn't he? It was a good knife, and he needed a good knife. If he had used it or even honed it, or took it out of his pocket and looked at it, that's all he had to do. If he'd liked it, I wouldn't have took out after you. I had to take out after you. Seems like to me my mother's chair is rocking a little. It's just the light. I don't take any truck with that. Seems to me like there's something not finished. Like when you half-finished a job and can't think what it was. Something I didn't get done. I shouldn't be here. I ought to be wandering around the world instead of sitting here on a good farm looking for a wife. There was something wrong, like it didn't get finished. Like it happened too soon and left something out. It's me should be where you are and you here. I never thought like this before. Maybe because it's late. It's later than that. I just looked out and it's first dawn. I don't think I fell off to sleep. How could the night go so fast? I can't go to bed now. I couldn't sleep anyways. The letter wasn't signed. Maybe Charles forgot he had intended to destroy it and sent it along. But Adam saved it for a time. And whenever he read it again, it gave him a chill, and he didn't know why. Chapter 5. On the ranch, the little Hamiltons began to grow up, and every year there was a new one. George was a tall, handsome boy, gentle and sweet, who had from the first a kind of courtliness. Even as a little boy, he was polite and what they used to call no trouble. From his father, he inherited the neatness of clothing and body and hair, and he never seemed ill-dressed, even when he was. George was a sinless boy and grew to be a sinless man. No crime of commission was ever attributed to him, and his crimes of omission were only misdemeanors. In his middle life, at about the time such things were known about, it was discovered that he had pernicious anemia. It is possible that his virtue lived on a lack of energy. Behind George, Will grew along, dumpy and stolid. Will had little imagination, but he had great energy. From childhood on, he was a hard worker, if anyone would tell him what to work at, and once told, he was indefatigable. He was a conservative, not only in politics, but in everything. Ideas he found revolutionary, and he avoided them with suspicion and distaste. Will liked to live so that no one could find fault with him, and to do that, he had to live as nearly like other people as possible.
Maybe his father had something to do with Will's distaste for either change or variation. When Will was a growing boy, his father had not been long enough in the Salinas Valley to be thought of as an old-timer. He was, in fact, a foreigner and an Irishman. At that time, the Irish were much disliked in America. They were looked upon with contempt, particularly on the East Coast, but a little of it must have seeped out to the West. And Samuel had not only variability, but was a man of ideas and innovations. In small cut-off communities, such a man is always regarded with suspicion until he has proved he is no danger to the others. A shining man like Samuel could and can cause a lot of trouble. He might, for example, prove too attractive to the wives of men who knew they were dull. Then there were his education and his reading, the books he bought and borrowed, his knowledge of things that could not be eaten or worn or cohabited with, his interest in poetry and his respect for good writing. If Samuel had been a rich man like the Thornes or the Delmars, with their big houses and wide flat lands, he would have had a great library. The Delmars had a library, nothing but books in it and paneled in oak. Samuel, by borrowing, had read many more of the Delmars' books than the Delmars had. In that day, an educated rich man was acceptable. He might send his sons to college without comment, might wear a vest and white shirt and tie in the daytime of a weekday, might wear gloves and keep his nails clean. And since the lives and practices of rich men were mysterious, who knows what they could use or not use? But a poor man, what need had he for poetry or for painting or for music not fit for singing or dancing? Such things didn't help him bring in a crop or keep a scrap of cloth on his children's backs. And if in spite of this he persisted, maybe he had reasons which would not stand the light of scrutiny. Take Samuel, for instance. He made drawings of work he intended to do with iron or wood. That was good and understandable, even enviable. But on the edges of the plans he made other drawings, sometimes trees, sometimes faces or animals or bugs, sometimes just figures that you couldn't make out at all. And these caused men to laugh with embarrassed uneasiness. Then, too, you never knew in advance what Samuel would think or say or do. It might be anything. The first few years after Samuel came to Salinas Valley, there was a vague distrust of him. And perhaps Will, as a little boy, heard talk in the San Lucas store. Little boys don't want their fathers to be different from other men. Will might have picked up his conservatism right then. Later, as the other children came along and grew, Samuel belonged to the valley, and it was proud of him, in the way a man who owns a peacock is proud. They weren't afraid of him anymore, for he didn't seduce their wives or lure them out of sweet mediocrity. The Salinas Valley grew fond of Samuel, but by that time Will was formed. Certain individuals, not by any means always deserving, are truly beloved of the gods. Things come to them without their effort or planning. Will Hamilton was one of these, and the gifts he received were the ones he could appreciate. As a growing boy, Will was lucky. Just as his father couldn't make money, Will couldn't help making it. When Will Hamilton raised chickens and his hens began to lay, the price of eggs went up. As a young man, when two of his friends who ran a little store came to the point of despondent bankruptcy, Will was asked to lend them a little money to tide them over a quarter's bills, and they gave him a 1/3 interest for a pittance. He wasn't niggardly. He gave them what they asked for. The store was on its feet within 1 year, expanding in 2, opening branches in 3, and its descendants, a great mercantile system, now dominate a large part of the area. Will also took over a bicycle and tool shop for a bad debt. Then a few rich people of the valley bought automobiles, and his mechanic worked on them. Pressure was put on him by a determined poet whose dreams were brass, cast iron, and rubber. This man's name was Henry Ford, and his plans were ridiculous, if not illegal. Will grumblingly accepted the southern half of the valley as his exclusive area,
and within 15 years the valley was too deep in fords, and Will was a rich man driving a Marmon. Tom, the third son, was most like his father. He was born in fury, and he lived in lightning. Tom came headlong into life. He was a giant in joy and enthusiasms. He didn't discover the world and its people, he created them. When he read his father's books, he was the first. He lived in a world shining and fresh and as uninspected as Eden on the sixth day. His mind plunged like a colt in a happy pasture, and when later the world put up fences, he plunged against the wire. And when the final stockade surrounded him, he plunged right through it and out. And as he was capable of giant joy, so did he harbor huge sorrow, so that when his dog died, the world ended. Tom was as inventive as his father, but he was bolder. He would try things his father wouldn't dare. Also, he had a large concupiscence to put the spurs in his flanks, and this Samuel did not have. Perhaps it was his driving sexual need that made him remain a bachelor. It was a very moral family he was born into. It might be that his dreams and his longing, and his outlets, for that matter, made him feel unworthy, drove him sometimes whining into the hills. Tom was a nice mixture of savagery and gentleness. He worked inhumanly, only to lose in effort his crushing impulses. The Irish do have a despairing quality of gaiety, but they also have a dour and brooding ghost that rides on their shoulders and peers in on their thoughts. Let them laugh too loudly, it sticks a long finger down their throats. They condemn themselves before they are charged, and this makes them defensive always. When Tom was 9 years old, he worried because his pretty little sister Molly had an impediment in her speech. He asked her to open her mouth wide and saw that a membrane under her tongue caused the trouble. "I can fix that," he said. He led her to a secret place far from the house, whetted his pocket knife on a stone, and cut the offending halter of speech. And then he ran away and was sick. The Hamilton house grew as the family grew. It was designed to be unfinished, so that lean-tos could jut out as they were needed. The original room and kitchen soon disappeared in a welter of these lean-tos. Meanwhile, Samuel got no richer. He developed a very bad patent habit, a disease many men suffer from. He invented a part of a threshing machine, better, cheaper, and more efficient than any in existence. The patent attorney ate up his little profit for the year. Samuel sent his models to a manufacturer who promptly rejected the plans and used the method. The next few years were kept lean by the suing, and the drain stopped only when he lost the suit. It was his first sharp experience with the rule that without money you cannot fight money. But he had caught the patent fever, and year after year the money made by threshing and by smithing was drained off in patents. The Hamilton children went barefoot, and their overalls were patched, and food was sometimes scarce, to pay for the crisp blueprints with cogs and planes and elevations. Some men think big, and some think little. Samuel and his sons Tom and Joe thought big, and George and Will thought little. Joseph was the fourth son, a kind of mooning boy, greatly beloved and protected by the whole family. He early discovered that a smiling helplessness was his best protection from work. His brothers were tough, hard workers, all of them. It was easier to do Joe's work than to make him do it. His mother and father thought him a poet because he wasn't good at anything else. And they so impressed him with this that he wrote glib verses to prove it. Joe was physically lazy and probably mentally lazy, too. He daydreamed out his life, and his mother loved him more than the others because she thought he was helpless. Actually, he was the least helpless, because he got exactly what he wanted with a minimum of effort. Joe was the darling of the family.
In feudal times, an ineptness with sword and spear headed a young man for the church. In the Hamilton family, Joe's inability properly to function at farm and forge headed him for a higher education. He was not sickly or weak, but he did not lift very well. He rode horses badly and detested them. The whole family laughed with affection when they thought of Joe trying to learn to plow. His torturous first furrow wound about like a flatland stream, and his second furrow touched his first only once, and then to cross it and wander off. Gradually, he eliminated himself from every farm duty. His mother explained that his mind was in the clouds, as though this were some singular virtue. When Joe had failed at every job, his father in despair put him to herding 60 sheep. This was the least difficult job of all, and the one classically requiring no skill. All he had to do was stay with the sheep. And Joe lost them. Lost 60 sheep and couldn't find them, where they were huddled in the shade in a dry gulch. According to the family's story, Samuel called the family together, girls and boys, and made them promise to take care of Joe after he was gone. For if they didn't, Joe would surely starve. Interspersed with the Hamilton boys were five girls. Una, the oldest, a thoughtful, studious, dark girl. Lizzie. I guess Lizzie must have been the oldest, since she was named for her mother. I don't know much about Lizzie. She early seemed to find a shame for her family. She married young and went away, and thereafter was seen only at funerals. Lizzie had a capacity for hatred and bitterness unique among the Hamiltons. She had a son, and when he grew up and married a girl Lizzie didn't like, she didn't speak to him for many years. Then there was Desi, whose laughter was so constant that everyone near her was glad to be there, because it was more fun to be with Desi than with anyone else. The next sister was Olive, my mother. And last was Molly, who was a little beauty with lovely blonde hair and violet eyes. These were the Hamiltons, and it was almost a miracle how Liza, skinny little biddy that she was, produced them year after year and fed them, baked bread, made their clothes, and clothed them with good manners and iron morals, too. It is amazing how Liza stamped her children. She was completely without experience in the world. She was unread and, except for the one long trip from Ireland, untraveled. She had no experience with men save only her husband, and that she looked upon as a tiresome and sometimes painful duty. A good part of her life was taken up with bearing and raising. Her total intellectual association was the Bible, except the talk of Samuel and her children, and to them she did not listen. In that one book she had her history and her poetry, her knowledge of peoples and things, her ethics, her morals, and her salvation. She never studied the Bible or inspected it, she just read it. The many places where it seemed to refute itself didn't confuse her in the least. And finally she came to a point where she knew it so well that she went right on reading it without listening. Liza enjoyed universal respect because she was a good woman and raised good children. She could hold her head up anywhere. Her husband and her children and her grandchildren respected her. There was a nail-hard strength in her, a lack of any compromise, a rightness in the face of all opposing wrongness, which made you hold her in a kind of awe, but not in warmth. Liza hated alcoholic liquors with an iron zeal. Drinking alcohol in any form she regarded as a crime against a properly outraged deity. Not only would she not touch it herself, but she resisted its enjoyment by anyone else. The result, naturally, was that her husband Samuel and all of her children had a good, lusty love for a drink. Once when he was very ill, Samuel asked, "Liza, couldn't I have a glass of whiskey to ease me?" She set her little, hard chin. "Would you go to the throne of God with liquor on your breath?" "You would not," she said. Samuel rolled over on his side and went about his illness without ease. When Liza was about 70, her eliminations slowed up, and her doctor told her to take a tablespoon of port wine for medicine. She forced down the first spoonful, making a crooked face, but it wasn't so bad. And from that moment, she never drew a completely sober breath. She always took the wine in a tablespoon. It was always medicine. But after a time, she was doing over a quart a day, and she was a much more relaxed and happy woman. Samuel and Liza Hamilton got all their children raised and well toward adulthood before the turn of the century. It was a whole clot of Hamiltons growing up on the ranch to the east of King City. And they were American children and young men and women. Samuel never went back to Ireland, and gradually he forgot it entirely. He was a busy man. He had no time for nostalgia. The Salinas Valley was the world. A trip to Salinas, 60 miles to the north at the head of the valley, was event enough for a year. And the incessant work on the ranch, the care and feeding and clothing of his bountiful family, took most of his time. But not all. His energy was large. His daughter Una had become a brooding student, tense and dark. He was proud of her wild, exploring mind. Olive was preparing to take county examinations after a stretch in the secondary school in Salinas. Olive was going to be a teacher, an honor like having a priest in the family in Ireland. Joe was to be sent to college because he was no damn good at anything else. Will was well along the way to accidental fortune. Tom bruised himself on the world and licked his cuts. Desi was studying dressmaking, and Molly, pretty Molly, would obviously marry some well-to-do man. There was no question of inheritance. Although the Hill Ranch was large, it was abysmally poor. Samuel sunk well after well and could not find water on his own land. That would have made the difference. Water would have made them comparatively rich. The one poor pipe of water pumped up from deep near the house was the only source. Sometimes it got dangerously low, and twice it went dry. The cattle had to come from the far fringe of the ranch to drink, and then go out again to feed. All in all, it was a good, firm-grounded family, permanent, and successfully planted in the Salinas Valley. Not poorer than many, and not richer than many either. It was a well-balanced family, with its conservatives and its radicals, its dreamers and its realists. Samuel was well pleased with the fruit of his loins.
Chapter 6. After Adam joined the army and Cyrus moved to Washington, Charles lived alone on the farm. He boasted about getting himself a wife, but he didn't go about doing it by the usual process of meeting girls, taking them to dances, testing their virtues, or otherwise, and finally slipping feebly into marriage. The truth of it was that Charles was abysmally timid of girls, and, like most shy men, he satisfied his normal needs in the anonymity of the prostitute. There is great safety for a shy man with a whore. Having been paid for, and in advance, she has become a commodity, and a shy man can be gay with her, and even brutal to her. Also, there is none of the horror of the possible turndown, which shrivels the guts of timid men. The arrangement was simple and reasonably secret. The owner of the inn kept three rooms on his top floor for transients, which he rented to girls for 2-week periods. At the end of 2 weeks, a new set of girls took their place. Mr. Hallam, the innkeeper, had no part in the arrangement. He could almost say with truth that he didn't know anything about it. He simply collected 5 times the normal rent for his 3 rooms. The girls were assigned, procured, moved, disciplined, and robbed by a whoremaster named Edwards, who lived in Boston. His girls moved in a slow circuit among the small towns, never staying anywhere more than 2 weeks. It was an extremely workable system. A girl wasn't in town long enough to cause remark, either by citizen or town marshal. They stayed pretty much in the rooms and avoided public places. They were forbidden, on pain of beating, to drink or make noise or to fall in love with anyone. Meals were served in their rooms,